Welcome to the conference. Please note, today's call is being recorded. Please stand by.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the GIGU Stage 2 Steering Committee Orientation Call. Thanks for joining us today. We are excited to get started on this next phase of the project, and we're looking forward to working with you again. This is Suzanne Tavares. I'll be managing the project this phase, and the rest of the team will introduce themselves in a minute after we go through the steering committee. So I'd like to just have a different slide set than everybody else here. The project team is myself, and Ashley, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. This is Ashley Lobon. I think I have met everyone on the call by now in stage one. I'm working with Suzanne on this stage as well to make sure that we can get through the rest of these measures, and looking forward to working with you guys again.
We also have Evan here.
Yeah, Evan Lanson. Excited to work with you guys again on this stage of the project.
All right, and we've had a transition for this stage. We'll have Reva Winkler will be our senior director on this stage. Tarun will be stepping off, and I'll let Reva introduce herself.
Hi, everybody. Thank you all for working with NQF. I'm Reva Winkler. I'm senior director here at Performance Measures, and I'm just beginning my 13th year of working at NQF with the endorsement of measures. So thanks all for being with us.
Okay, so now we'd like to go through the steering committee, and then we'll just do a rundown of which developers are on the call as well. I am going to read off a list of the steering committee members because we're not, we know we've got some people dialing in Friday instead of today. And we are also going to ask you to do a brief conflict of interest review when you do your introduction. So what we'd like to do is we'll go through the list and then have you say that you're here and then make any disclosure that you wish to make. Just because you wish to make a disclosure does not mean you have a conflict of interest. It's just letting us know something that might be relevant to your work on this project. We don't need to go through your CV. We just want you to know about topics we'll be discussing today on this call, particularly consulting, speaking engagements, grant money, research money, anything that would be relevant to the measures in front of us today. We also want to make sure that you remember conflict of interest and disclosure is not just financial. A lot of committee members will say, I have no financial conflict of interest, and that certainly could be part of the scenario, but because many many folks that are on our committees do volunteer work as well, we would like to make sure you disclose that as well, just anything that might be related to the measures. And finally, we just want to make sure you all remember that you're serving as individuals. You're not here as representatives of your employer or of the organization that nominated you or anything like that. You know, you're not here as representing the American Society of something. You're here because you're an expert in and of yourself. So with that, I will run through the list, starting with the co-chairs. Andy Baskin is one of our co-chairs, but he'll be on the Friday call. Chris?
Yes, I'm Chris Steigel. I'm a urologist at UCLA. My disclosures are I'm a co-founder of a company called Wiser Care. I don't think it's related to this. I'm also NIH PI on topics that do relate to GU quality of care.
Thanks. Liliana Bordna? I think she's calling Friday. Saheed Butt?
Yes, hi. I'm a practicing gastroenterologist in Columbia, Maryland, member of a 16-person GI group. I'm also CEO of Medisolve that provides implementation of electronic quality measures for hospitals and health systems. I do not have any specific disclosures for this project, and I have no conflict of interest.
Thanks. Robert Ellis?
Hi. I'm the director at the Center for the Study of Services and Consumers Checkbook, and I have no disclosures to make.
Thank you. Nancy Fowler? Okay. Edward Gill? Okay. Johannes Koch? Jennifer Lightdale. She emailed and said she'll be dialing in late, so she may not have joined us yet. Richard Luckmeyer. I think he's also coming Friday. Elaine Markland.
Hi, I'm on, and I'm currently on staff associate professor at UAB as a geriatrician in the Department of Medicine. I also work for the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I do receive a research grant funding from the Department of Veteran Affairs and NIH on the clinical treatment of
Okay, thank you. Paul McGurian. Okay, John Morton. Ann Pelletier Cameron.
I'm on the call. Ann Pelletier Cameron. I'm a urologist at the University of Michigan. For closures, I'm a co-investigator in an NIH-funded study on bowel and bladder management after spinal cord injury, and the PI on a study on post-prostatectomy incontinence, although I received no financial remuneration for that.
Okay, thank you. Stuart Reynolds?
Yeah, hi. This is Stuart Reynolds. I'm a urologist from Vanderbilt University, and I have no disclosures to declare.
Okay, and Philip Schoenfeld? Okay. I know there's a number of developers who have dialed in. If you could just real quick say your name and what organization you're with, that would be great.
This is Erin Giovanetti. I'm with the National Committee for Quality Assurance.
Okay.
Catherine.
This is Eden.
Oh. Hi, Eden.
This is Eden Essex with the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy.
Catherine Ost and colleagues from AMA PCPI.
Bonnie Deer and colleagues from Active Health Management.
Judy Flood, quality manager, also from Active Health Management.
George Wu from Active Health Management.
Bonnie Ferris from Quality Quest.
All right, do we have any other developers? Okay, great. Committee folks, just so you know, the developers are here as your reference. If you have any questions as we go through the checklist, you can ask those questions. Just to quickly go over the agenda for the call, we are going to go over the stage one checklist. And talk about whether the developers answered your questions from stage one. And in that discussion, which will be facilitated by Chris and Ashley, we will be deciding whether the measures are going to be discussed in stage two. And then once we're done with that, we will give you an overview of measurement, talk about NQF's measure evaluation process for the remaining three criteria, and then answer your questions. All right. So now I'm going to turn it over to Evan to talk about the CDP.
Great. Before we start, I just want to make sure everybody can see the slides on their webinar. Everything's coming through properly.
Yes.
Great. Excellent. All right. So we'll move on to the consensus development process. When we started this project, we did a two-stage process, and we went through the first phase, as you all know, to really focus on the importance and to measure and report. To really do the concept of the measure. And here in stage two, we're going to do the fully specified measure. We want to focus on the scientific acceptability, the feasibility, and usability, the meat of the measure, the testing. And so this process will go through a similar process to the stage one that we went through. We'll review it as a steering committee. We'll go through an approval process. It will go out for another comment period in addition to the member comment that's already happened. And then it'll go for a vote. Then it'll go to CSEC again, and then finally for board ratification, where it'll become an endorsed measure. And here we've laid it out in sequential order. You can see these measures went through technical assistance after they were approved as a concept. Not all of the measure developers had to submit at least one of their measures to go through this technical assistance process. And you can see that the developer must demonstrate that the checklist for stage two review has been met. So during the first stage, we've put together checklist recommendations that we'll be going through today on this call, and the developer had to justify the checklist and during their submission for stage two. We're going to have conference calls to discuss these measures during the steering committee review, another draft report, developer comment, member voting, and then finally CSAC and board approval. Osteppy, do we have any questions on what I've covered so far?
Nope.
Great. We'll continue on. All right. So what will be evaluated in stage two? So as I mentioned, we'll have the checklist review, and that will go today. It'll also be discussed on the Friday call with the other group of steering committee members. And your final recommendations for that will be due Monday morning at 9 a.m. You should have all received the survey today. I sent out via SurveyMonkey, and that's how we're going to collect the information for the checklist review. So we'll be able to discuss it today, and then you can either do it on the call today. You can submit your recommendations, or you'll have some time if you want to think back and read through the checklist or the measure submission. So the rest of the evaluation throughout the rest of the process will be on the scientific acceptability. So those are the measure specifications and the testing results, and then our feasibility and usability and use criteria. So here's our stage two activities and timeline. You see we're having orientation today and Friday. We'll be having the conference calls on April 3rd and April 8th. Those should be on your calendar. It'll go out for a public and member comment throughout May, and then we'll have member voting in July. They'll go into CSAC review in August, and following CSAC review, they'll go out for board endorsement. And then there's an appeals process, which is a 30-day process, where appeals can be submitted for the measures that were endorsed. Okay, so we'll be evaluating seven measures in stage two. These are the measures that were approved during stage one and that the developer decided to submit for stage two. You see we have five maintenance measures. So those are measures that were previously endorsed and are going through the maintenance process, and two new measures, so measures that were new to stage one and are now going to go through the full review for initial endorsement. We kind of have an uneven split between GI and GU. We have six GI measures and only one GU measure. We're going to be relying on your expertise in that area for your individual measures, whether it be GI or GU.
This is Ann Pelchick-Cameron. I just have a quick question.
Yes.
So out of all the measures that at our initial meeting we had reviewed, so you're saying that some of those the developers have decided not to move on, and that's why they're missing from this list?
Yes. Those measures were approved as a concept, and they weren't fully specified or tested yet. And between the time in stage one and stage two, the developers haven't had enough time to fully specify and test, and so they weren't brought back yet. They're still an approved concept and can be brought back for this stage two review.
Okay, thank you.
But some were not, Ann. Put forward by the CSAC.
Okay. Okay, perfect.
Any other questions on that? All right, great. We'll move on. So here's a list of the measures. I'm sure you're all familiar with them from reviewing them for stage one. We have measures from Active Health, from the AMA PCPI, from Quality Quest, ART, and we have these are the GI measures. And then for GU, we also have a measure from NCQA.
Hello, this is Johannes Koch joining late. I'm sorry.
Great. Do you want to do the disclosure?
Yeah. Thanks for joining us. If we could just ask you real quick to disclose anything that might be relevant to the measures that we'll be discussing today, that would be great.
Myself, correct? Yes, Johannes Koch. I'm with Virginia Mason, and I don't know that it's relevant, but I've always disclosed that I'm part of the AGA Political Action Committee.
Thank you. Have we had any other committee members dial in that haven't introduced themselves yet? Okay, great.
Excellent. So at this point, I will turn it back over. I'll turn it to Ashley, and she will continue with the presentation.
So the next part of the call, we're going to focus on reviewing the measure checklist And this is going to be primarily facilitated by Chris, but I did want to give the group a little bit of background on kind of how we got to this point and what your kind of task is for this portion of the call. Like Evan mentioned, if you are sitting at a computer and have access to the email that was distributed from SurveyMonkey to open the survey and kind of, you know, complete the questions for each measure as we go, I think you'll find that it will be useful. So when you get off the call, you'll have to go back and try to remember what was discussed. So strongly encourage you to do that. So again, this portion of the call is really to determine which measures should be put forth for a full committee review. If you recall, just a little bit of a kind of history on reminder of what happened in stage one, we reviewed the concepts for each of the measures. The steering committee made several recommendations to developers for how to improve or refine the concept, and staff essentially documented each of those recommendations for each measure and provided them back to the developers at the end of stage one, so that they had a record of the recommendations and what they should be doing before the measure came back into stage two. As kind of in addition to the checklist, when those measures went through CSAC, there was a very strong, I'm trying to think of the word, I guess even stronger recommendation to the point of wanting it required that the steering committee recommendations should be met or at least responded to in some way from each developer so that there was some rationale or justification on why either checklist items, how they were considered, or why or why not they were not met at the time of submission to stage two. So the purpose of this process is really to take the committee through the checklist for each measure to determine whether or not, based on the recommendations that were made, that you feel that what the developer has responded with was sufficient to move forward to stage two. So as a result of the call today, and you submit your vote, there'll be another orientation call on Friday. Checklist. Staff will compile those votes. And the whatever comes out of those surveys will determine which measures we actually discuss on the calls on April 3rd and April 8th. So if there are some measures of the seven measures that the committee votes should not move forward to stage two, then only whatever that subset is will be the focus of the remaining calls. So again, the measures that we'll be reviewing today for the checklist are all approved as concepts. So if you decide that there are measures that you don't feel like should move, you don't believe should move forward to stage two and have a full review against the remaining criteria, they will still remain approved concepts, and the developers will still have the opportunity to bring them back into our process when they feel that they are ready. And NQF staff, while we don't have a GIGU project scheduled at this time, we are we'll be working with developers to determine at what point they can bring their fully specified measures back into the process into either future projects against other committees. We're doing a lot of internal work right now and reworking our process, so we're definitely committed to ensuring that developers have an opportunity to bring their measures back. So as an aside, if you decide that you know, the measures aren't ready for stage two, it doesn't mean that they die. It just means that they're not ready at this time for review against the remaining criteria.
And can I ask, basically, all these developers to get to this point have had to work with NQF staff for technical assistance. So what we're looking at today is the work product after working with NQF. Is that correct?
That is correct. And, yes, that's correct.
So it's possible that we're getting their sort of best effort, and if we say that it's not sufficient, then there's maybe something fundamentally wrong with how your organization is approaching their measure. Is that right?
That's possible, yes. That is quite possible.
Okay.
Yes. Does anyone else have questions kind of about the checklist review or the implications of the review, the purpose of what we're doing here? Okay.
So, hi, before you move on, this is Jennifer Lightdale. I just had to join the call a bit late. Sorry.
Sure.
And I'm sorry, this is Johannes again. Can you just remind me where the SurveyMonkey is? I'm lost in the flood of emails here. Sorry.
Yeah, it was distributed this morning around 11 a.m. It was sent from my email address.
Ah, very good. Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
Jennifer, thanks for joining us. Before we get started, could you, since we'll be reviewing measures on this call, we need to do a quick disclosure of interest. Can you let the committee and the developers know if there's anything that you need to disclose?
I don't have anything to disclose.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So with that said, for those of you that are sitting at a computer and have accessed the webinar, there's a slide on the screen now with two questions, which should mirror what you will see in the SurveyMonkey, which will ask you whether or not you believe the developer has adequately responded to the committee's recommendations and concerns that are indicated on the checklist. And if not, we're asking for just a brief explanation of, you know, why you believe it has not been adequately responded to. And then the following question is whether or not you believe this measure should be considered in stage two and evaluated against the remaining criteria. So pretty brief, but we will be looking for some discussion around, you know, why you do or do not believe that should happen, particularly for the developers on the phone so they can understand, you know, the committee's rationale for their recommendations. So with that said.
Ashley?
Yes.
This is Zahid. I have a quick question. Can
sure.
we ask? Can we ask a question outside the checklist, or is it purely just the checklist and nothing else?
We like to focus on the checklist. However, if there are certain questions that you need to ask to give you more context for certain items on the checklist, we do realize that some of the things that we indicate on the checklist kind of require you to go look at the measure, and it may spark other questions that you may need to help you make your decision. So to the best of our ability, we'd like to keep it scoped down to what, you know, things that are related to what's listed on the checklist. But, yeah, just because of the time that we have, we want to try to make sure we keep it focused and concise.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, with that said, I think I'll hand it over to Chris maybe with one last note. For those of you that were able to review the memo, we did assign lead reviewers, and to the extent that Chris may call on you, if you're able to provide, you know, some insight on your assigned measure for those of you that are on the call. There may be some lead discussions for other measures that aren't on the call, but just for those of you who have been assigned a measure, if you're on the call and you have some insights to offer, we welcome that as well. So I will just hand it over to Chris and take it away.
Okay, so the first one we're going to review is 0098, which is the NCQA measure regarding urinary incontinence assessment, characterization, and plan of care for incontinence in women age 65 and older. And I just want to first apologize if there's any background noise. I'm in a clinic, and it got swamped with sewage, and so I'm in a public space right now speaking. So I'll try to keep that to a minimum if I can. If I'm not sure if folks can see the checklist, if we're all on the same page on the NQF website, but there's a on page 5 of this checklist is where 0098 starts. And there are specific recommendations to the developer and the developer responses. And so they possibly could review those to start. So the first one is the committee recommendations were that e-measure specifications are strongly recommended. And the developer comments that they essentially are saying that they don't have funding to do it, that they were going to do it, but they don't have funding. That was a response. And if there's any staff comments about that, you know, please let me know. The second one is consider the addition of an option for a patient choice of no treatment, and the developer says that there is an option if you consider reassessment and lifestyle modification as no treatment. The third comment was expand the age group to include commercial and menopausal populations. This is a Medicare age population in this measure, and they say that's a great idea, but it's not feasible for them to do that at this time. They may do it later. Those were the comments I see. Is there anything else from the staff that I missed in terms of the checklist?
No, that's it.
Okay. Does the group have any comments, questions, or concerns about the developers' responses?
Chris, it's Ann Cameron. I'm sorry, but I'm just not finding the print version of this checklist.
Can someone from the staff direct Ann to the website? I'm on a website, basically, that it's the NQF website. There's a link in it.
Okay.
Link in one of our emails that you received.
Hi, Ann. There
you can tell me the date that the email was sent. I'll be able to find it.
And there are multiple ways to get to it. I just sent an email out at 1 o'clock with an additional way that doesn't require you to log in. They're posted on our public site when they went out for comment.
Okay.
So you can access those PDFs through that. They're listed under the member comment section of Stage 2. And then this should be all seven PDFs are there.
And the PDF on the bookmark section says checklist, and that can take you to the actual checklist where these comments are. So does everyone else have access and feel comfortable with what they're reviewing? Anyone not comfortable with what they're reviewing?
There are so many things on the website. I'm not finding it fast. Sure.
Understood. If you follow the link that was sent out, I guess, by the staff just recently, that probably is the fastest way to deal with it.
We're going to try to send them out, actually linked directly to the PDFs right now. So hold on for about 2 minutes, and you should have those in your inbox. They'll be linked directly to the PDFs, so it should save you a little bit of time.
Thank you.
I mean, essentially, the NCQA declined to make changes recommended by the committee, and it's a combination of funding and resource constraints. And so I think the decision is whether or not the changes are so critical that the measure shouldn't move forward because it impacts the importance of measure and report. So I don't have the emails in my inbox. I don't know if anyone else has them yet.
Yeah, and I went to the one that Evan sent, and I'm in the area under member comment. And when I click on the PDF, it's just a 16-page or 17-page document, and I just don't see where the checklist is located.
So what I'm looking – so basically I think if you – do you have the bookmarks – section on the left there, Ann?
The email just arrived from Evan.
Okay.
And when you open up the PDFs, it starts with a memo that includes the checklist responses. So it might not show way up around the first page, but if you scroll down to the second page, that's where the table starts that has the checklist responses.
Okay, that's helpful. So if everyone gets that email, you'll see then if you click on it, the PDF opens up, and then you click on checklist on the left there where the bookmarks are, and you'll come. You scroll down past 0030, which was withdrawn, and you'll come to on page 5 of the PDF, the actual comments back and forth that we just talked about. So page 5 of this PDF. Is anyone not there yet? Everyone is there?
Yes.
I have found my way.
Oh, good. Okay. So, you know, with that in mind, you know, there's basically three comments here about e-measures, option of no treatment, and expanding the age group, They were unable to make these changes. This is a renewal or continuation of an existing measure. Any comments about their responses? No comments. Okay, I'll tell you my view is that it's the, you know, basically the addition of an option for no choice. I think it's reasonable enough in what they've commented on. The e-measure lack of a specification isn't a fatal flaw in my mind, and expanding the age group is important to do, but it's important to measure it in older women as well. So I don't think it is a fatal flaw of this measure either. So that's my viewpoint. I don't know if anyone has any other comments about it. Okay. So then I guess what you can do is, if you are so inclined, you can vote currently on your SurveyMonkey link, which, you know, if you look at that opened up, there's basically two questions to answer. The first is, did the measure developers address the stage one checklist recommendation satisfactorily? And if not, please say why. And the second one is, should the measure move forward to a full evaluation in terms of scientific acceptability, usability, and feasibility, which we'll discuss in April. So those are contingent questions, and you can either handle that now or you can come back to it if you want to consider it. Okay. So then we'll move on to the next one on this list, which is, I'll bring it up now, 60622, and these are all GU measures. This one's from Active Health. And I can review on page 2, I can review with the group the comments and the responses. So the first comment was, this measure should include chronic GERD patients, and the developer response is basically that it is including them in the denominator. The next committee response was, exclusion should be clarified in terms of previous malignancy. And this is basically upper GI study in adults with alarm symptoms, which is what we talked about when we met last time. And the exclusion has been clarified as metastatic malignancy. The next comment is, Barrett's esophagus should be included. And they say that that this condition has been removed from the denominator exclusions, and those patients with Barrett's will be included if they meet the remaining denominator criteria, so that's responsive. The measure should be expanded to include patients under 18 as well, and they complied with that. Additional evidence should be provided for evidence criteria, and they say, yes, please see the submission form section 1C28. Additional information performance gaps has been provided for us to review, and define, specify the testing procedures for the numerator more clearly. So that's on the measure testing submission form attachment. Consider also specifying the numerator in a patient population that would be more broadly impactful. And they've modified the measure so that it has two separate numerators, one for those in the general population and one for those who are at high risk. But they haven't tested it, and they recommend separating these high-risk individuals into another denominator and reporting it separately. And I guess they had to back and forth with NQF staff about this. Staff, is there any comments about that?
No, but you should see the addendum, I think, in red text at the bottom of that last
right.
Comment. So.
So basically, they're currently testing this change. But we don't have any data about how this affects the measure. It's just not enough time for them to do it. And I guess we can if people want to look at the evidence criteria, that can be found in this document, right? Under the evidence part there.
Yes.
The full submission, so the evidence is listed in the document as well. It should be a bookmark for the evidence.
Okay. So I assume that most people on this call haven't had the time to go over that specific form in terms of additional evidence on evidence criteria and additional evidence on performance gaps. So we can either discuss that now or people can read it over and make their own decisions. Does anyone in the group, has anyone in the group reviewed the evidence or, that they've submitted, or have any comments about the performance gap additional information?
So, Chris, this is Zahid. I remember from the original discussion that one of the concerns was that the numerator statements had gastric emptying study as the only test that would qualify as a positive on the numerator side, but that's not in the questions that were posed.
So what you're saying is that there's like an issue that wasn't raised in the checklist?
It at least seems to me. I think that there was some discussion that, for instance, if someone had a gastric emptying study done looking for, you know, this is looking for GERD patients with alarm symptoms and looking for, I suppose, esophageal issues, and that would actually be counted towards the numerator if they had a single gastric emptying study.
So can the staff comment about that?
I'm not sure exactly what Zahid is referring to, but just on the page below that in the PDF, there is, and you can read the numerator statement. Maybe that will help refresh some of our memories. The patient,
right.
The numerator states that patients who have had at least one esophageal procedure, upper GI study, and that includes upper GI radiologic exam with high-density barium, with or without delayed films, esophageal or gastric motility study, gastric emptying study, gastric analysis test, upper GI endoscopy, or upper GI series. And it goes on to say, or gastrectomy, evidence of at least one gastric or esophageal cancer diagnosis in the past 12 months. And so I think maybe if you still have an issue around that, it might be useful to ask the developers who are on the phone about whether or not that is something that is still warranted. I vaguely remember that discussion, but I'm not sure why it was or was not captured.
Right. So my question only is that if a patient who has alarm symptoms has a gastric emptying study, would they be counted as having had that evaluated? That's the implication of this numerator statement. And if that's true, then I'd like to know if it's true.
So this is Bonnie here from Active Health. Can I comment to that?
Please.
So, yes, it's correct. It's in the numerator. This was not brought up to us as a concern earlier in any sort of documented correspondence. If it is the request or recommendation of the NQF that we remove that, we could certainly do that. That would require, then, again, retesting without that piece in the numerator if the NQF had that requirement as well.
Well, it seems like it's unfair if it wasn't communicated specifically. I don't know whether this is an important point or not. I'm not a gastroenterologist, but I assume that it's important enough for Zahid to raise it. Zahid, can you maybe explain to the urologist in the audience what the concern is going to be?
So, Chris, I think that this measure really is trying to address people who have chronic reflux and have alarm symptoms. And in the context of chronic reflux, the alarm symptoms really are to look for any esophageal lesions, perhaps with Barrett's and esophageal cancer, and that's kind of what it comes down to.
Uh-huh.
And my concern is that the way the numerator statement is fashioned, that if a patient had just gastric emptying study and no esophageal evaluation at all, that they would have been counted as having met this measure.
Okay.
And I think that would not be accurate. I'd certainly be interested in thinking in asking for the other GI input. And I know there are at least a couple other GI people on the call.
Okay.
So this is Jennifer Lightdale from GI. Actually, I'm pediatric GI. But maybe the answer is to, with looking at the data on performance gap, and instead of using the word upper GI study, if you could change that to evaluation of the esophagus, you know, appropriate evaluation of the esophagus, So the one thing obviously is a little bit confusing is there's a lot of different alarm systems, symptoms. So on the one hand, most of what is asking for is their cancer, but somebody could have a stricture they're looking for with a...
Right. So I think that this is really trying to say that if someone has GERD and alarm symptoms, they should have their esophagus evaluated.
So evaluation of the esophagus, instead of using the term upper GI, which is just not quite specific enough, broaden it.
So the thing is that we have to, I mean, these guys are specifying these tests for their numerator,
right.
And if we're going to ask them to change that, that would require retesting. And so my concern is that if this was a point that was raised in our initial meeting and wasn't communicated to them, then that's a problem on our end. And I want to be fair to the developers. So maybe the staff could comment about that, what they think we should do about that.
It says endoscopic evaluation all the way through until that last moment when it says upper GI.
Right.
So
upper GI is not an inadequate, inadequate evaluation for alarm symptoms.
A gastric motility study by itself as a single test would be inadequate evaluation of alarm symptoms in GERD.
Okay. In terms of the developer that's on the call, I guess changing this would require retesting?
If from my understanding, the NQF does require us to retest and revalidate if we're making a drastic change to our measure.
Uh-huh.
And again, because this is so late in the game, we would ask that the NQF come up with a consensus agreement on what exactly they would like to see in the numerator. Based on, you know, expert opinions across the committee and give us adequate time to put those changes into place after we've discussed them internally and adequate time to test.
I think
right now it's really late.
Of course.
Can I ask a quick question? This is Johannes Koch. in this evaluation, is there a way to identify or in existing data how many patients have had only an esophageal or gastric motility study and only a gastric emptying study? My suspicion is that these are commonly done in concert with an endoscopy, which is what we're actually wanting to measure. So I'm wondering whether we're creating a bar that doesn't need to be done rather than having to retest the entire thing without that.
For us to do that, it would require a fair bit of effort to go to that level of analysis. See which, if it only fired off one data point as opposed to two, if that's what the request is. But certainly that is something we could look into. But again, it would take time and resource, unfortunately.
Sure.
Can I ask a question? Sorry, I'm just looking at 1B.2 and 1B.3, right? So you have 392 patients who are in your numerator, and of these, 260 had upper endoscopy, is what's written in 1B.2. And then I think where Zahid is bringing up is in 1B.3, it says 260 had an upper GI. If you just change that wording to upper endoscopy, it's the same 260 patients.
So we're referring to two separate parts here because earlier I thought we were referring to the numerator statement, and now we're talking about the data, the performance gap in 1B. So if that's what you're referring to, we can certainly change that statement easily enough.
Right. I think that just clarifies that what you're talking about, what we think you're talking about.
I think the issue is more if it can conceptually it's inadequate to have just a upper GI or a motility study to rule out warning symptoms as being from cancer in the numerator. That is the more, I mean, it's possible given the data that everyone did have endoscopy, given that they're using the same terms, but going forward, there may be populations where everyone doesn't have an endoscopy and instead has a motility study.
Okay.
So, you know, this is something that I kind of defer to the staff in terms of the way to handle this, because it sounds like this was a concern that he felt that he brought up that wasn't communicated to the developer. And I'm not sure how to manage that in terms of the timeline.
Chris, this is Tarun. I have a few suggestions for you and the committee. The first is that, as we described in the two-stage pilot, the developer could have a stage one approved concept, and they would have another opportunity in the future to submit the second stage of testing. So it wouldn't be necessarily in this stage two evaluation, but we would offer another opportunity in the future for them to bring back, should the committee recommend some changes at a future date. The second thing I want to just make sure we keep in mind is that the evaluation of the specifications really is a stage two issue when we're looking at the precision and the validity of the specifications of how the measure is actually designed. Some of these issues that are being raised are really issues with the specifications, which are certainly under the evaluation of the stage two. So, you know, we want to kind of keep stage one clean in terms of evaluation of the concept, and the specifications will be evaluated fully in stage two. So it's not that we're re-evaluating the measure in stage two, but we're really looking at how the measure is designed and making sure that the way the measure is designed is valid and reliable. And it seems that maybe some of these issues that are being raised are related to the specification. However, I'll yield that back to you guys in terms of how you want to handle that.
And just to piggyback on Tarun, I mean, I think, you know, Bonnie mentioned in their checklist that they are still testing parts of the measure. So it is still somewhat in progress. So, and again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the checklist review, that we will make opportunities for the developers to bring back the measure within the 18-month period based on it being an approved concept. So that is still on the table. The measure does not die if you guys don't feel like it's ready. There are other opportunities for them to, you know, continue to pursue endorsement.
So okay. I think I'm okay with that in that context.
Okay. So it sounds like the other elements to consider are whether, you know, the evidence that was additionally supplied is adequate, and evidence on performance gap is adequate. So I would suggest that we, since no one's really read that, we read it individually and make our decision and vote. But I think in terms of everything else, I feel that we've gotten a nice response from the developer, and this last matter is of importance, but maybe more related to the scientific evidence or specifications around usability or something like that we could talk about at the next call. Any other comments? Okay. So then, since we have an hour left here, let's go to the next one, which is 0635. So please open that one up. And go to the checklist there, which is on page, looks like that's the first page here, it looks like. So this is, everyone can see the list here of questions. Let's see. This checklist is a little different in terms of how it's looked at. Is anyone from the staff, can you comment on the way that this is, all these blank staff comments?
Yeah, that actually looks like this was the wrong document. I apologize for that. It should actually be the checklist that's in there.
Okay, so I see a bunch of blank comments.
Yeah, let's skip over that and go to 658, and we'll come back to 635.
All right, so we'll go to 658. Go to 658. Open that up, please. And this. So this 658 is looking at surveillance on pulse surveillance and making sure the appropriate follow-up interval for normal colonoscopy in average-risk patients. It's an overuse measure. So there were several comments here. I don't know if there, anyone on the call was primary reviewer for this one to make any overall comments.
So it's Johannes. I'm just seeing this, so I'm scanning it quickly.
Right.
I mean, I think the criteria for waiting 10 years on an average risk is a pretty well-defined criteria. So I think the whole thing is a little less controversial than when what we get into polyps and polyp surveillance, which is the next one.
Okay. So there are some specific comments here. Essentially, we can go over them individually now. I haven't read them at length myself, but basically the first one is, rather than measuring whether the appropriate interval is recommended, consider specifying the measure to look at colonoscopies performed and then do a look back to see whether the last colonoscopy was performed in the last 10 years. So basically it's changing how the measure specified to look at actual procedure use versus recommendation. And that would bring it closer to an impactful outcome measure. And their response is that they declined to do that because of concerns about burden on referring physicians who basically have been at the patient rate for 10 years. That's my read of that one. And then the other comments here are that patients age 50 years or older receiving a screening colonoscopy who had at least a recommendation to repeat colonoscopy in 1 year due to bowel cleansing. And then they said this is an exception built in for medical reasons for not recommending at least a 10-year follow-up interval. And so they're going to report the exception rates, basically. So that's how they're handling that situation. Mm-hmm. Consider adjusting the upper age limit for older patients, including inflammatory bowel disease, and better define above-average risk. So they refer to guidelines from the ACS regarding what high risk means. And they define what that is in this document. Those with a personal family history of colorectal cancer, adenomas, inflammatory bowel disease, or high-risk genetic syndromes. And they are happy with the recommendation for an upper age limit. And they will bring these cuts back to the expert work group when the measure is due for review and enhancement. So I guess that means that they're not going to do it now. So is that what that means from the staff?
Yes.
They're going to hold off on it. What is when the measure is due for review and enhancement? That means within their organization, they'll look at it when it's their time to look at it again, I guess. But they're not going to adjust it right now. And then clarifying the specifications, whether the exceptions are included in the denominator or should be calculated as a separate measure. And the exceptions are not included in the denominator, and they're going to report them side by side. Okay. And the developer should expand on the available evidence and the details of the meta-analysis to demonstrate body of evidence available support. And they said that they did their best, and it's been approved before, basically. And then e-measure specifications are present, will be submitted in stage two. Mm-hmm. So essentially, I guess the biggest change we recommended was involving looking at actual colonoscopy use as opposed to recommendations. And they're just saying it's too much of a burden to do that. That is more of a feasibility question, I think, than anything else. So we can get back to it at that time point when we're in stage two, in my point of view. Any other comments about their responses to the rest of them? Okay. So in that sense, then basically people can vote in the SurveyMonkey link, or they can defer and think about it some more. All right, so let's go to 0659. I'm opening that up.
Just note that 5-9 is actually in the same checklist as 6-5-8 because we sent one checklist per developer. So if you just scroll down to the bottom of the checklist that you were just looking at, you should actually 6-5-9 as well.
Okay, so this is actually the inappropriate use one for colonoscopy intervals for patient with adenomatous polyps.
Right.
All right. Any comments? Just before we get going on these. Okay. So. The first comment is the developer should expand on the available evidence on the details of the meta-analysis to better demonstrate the similar to last time. And they said they did their best to do it, and that the NQF already accepted their first evidence basis when they submitted it. 659, so the interval specified in the measure does not match the recommendations in the evidence 3-plus years versus 5 years, and then consider how those can be aligned to measure the measure's evidence-based. And they argued that they are consistent with evidence-based guidelines, working with an interval of 3 to 5 years for patients with adenomatous polyps. I don't know if that's true or not. Can anyone comment on that?
Well, this is Johannes again. The challenge comes in is it's not just whether you have an adenoma, it's the size of the adenoma and what your previous findings were. So I think the challenge in it is that there are guidelines. The problem is in aggregating all of that information in one measure, right? So you have this colonoscopy, but you actually don't know what their previous colonoscopy report might have been, and you don't know what other risk factors they may have. So I recognize that this is a challenging area. Now, if you have an adenoma, it's going to be somewhere in the 3 to 5. So in some ways, when there's really big fish to fry, are you going to worry about whether it's 4 years or 3 years or 5 years? I'm not certain, but they're reflecting on the complexity of doing this based on guidelines when some of the information may have required you know what the previous endoscopy was. And some of that can be very difficult to define.
So essentially, they can't get that specific and with the available data, and they're going to lump everything together, basically?
I think they're going to take the 3 to 5 years and treat it as essentially as one group. So it eliminates people who have cancer or high-risk polyp. And it eliminates the other end of the spectrum, which was the previous metric, which is people with a normal colonoscopy. So this is the intermediate risk, and you'd want to make sure that people aren't recommending 10 years for people who are at intermediate risk, and you want to make sure that they're not recommending 1 year for people in whom that would be inappropriate.
Okay. Well, as a urologist, this is definitely something I'm going to defer to my colleagues in GI on in terms of, you know, how that would play out. And in terms of how it affects the importance of this measure, any general comments about that?
So this is Ahid. I think I kind of agree with what Johannes sort of summarized based on their responses.
Okay. Okay. Well, then, with that in mind, the group can either go to the SurveyMonkey and vote, unless there's more comments. And we can go to the next one, 2056. All right. And this is the colonoscopy quality index. Remember, this is a very interesting debate that we went through. When I open this link up, I'm just getting the, see if I can find the bookmark part. Did you guys send around the checklist for this?
It doesn't seem to be.
I don't see a checklist on this.
This one is at the end.
It was included in an appendix. I couldn't separate it out, so it's included at the end.
Okay. All right. So
they sent it to us as a combined PDF. So.
Okay.
Ooh.
So we actually had a subsequent call with the staff with these folks to address some of their concerns, and there's been lots of back and forth. Can someone tell us where the checklist is on this document, specifically what page?
This is Eden from ASG. If you look at page 98 of the PDF, 98 to 103, I think is where everybody wants to look.
Okay. All right. So, all right. So I see page 98. There's one.
'98 to 103. You'll see it
okay.
On those pages.
I see. They're just turned sideways. Let me see if I can rotate these. Okay. So. Item 2. So basically, the committee on item two of this said that this component should not be included in the composite. It's basically standard medical practice, whether endoscopy is performed a high quality colonoscopy for colorectal cancer or polyp surveillance. And this is basically giving the person credit for a standardized medical risk assessment prior to colonoscopy. Is that correct? And for, okay, so basically they said that the colonoscopy is an invasive procedure and assessing ASA is important and should be done. So essentially it's a, you know, it's a question of, for the group about whether the assessment of anesthesia risk prior to colonoscopy warrants its own measure or whether it's a standard of care that should be implied. Any comments about that? Okay. So they didn't feel a change is necessary. Standard three, standardized assessment of bowel prep, and basically we said that just documenting the bowel prep isn't really an indicator of quality, and there should be some other way to tell whether it's high quality. For example, whether the procedure was rescheduled to a poor bowel prep, and they basically also said that it's an important quality step, and they feel that it should be included. They didn't agree with us. So, any comments on that?
So, Chris, just quick clarification here. The task, just so that we're clear on the task, is to, you know, you guys already had a lot of discussion around these elements. It's to open up the discussion on whether or not the recommendations from the committee were addressed by the developer, yes or no, and if they were not, whether they're essentially if they're big enough issues to stop it from going forward to stage two. And so just to focus the discussion, that's the goal. The goal would not be to try to rehash each of these elements again, because you guys mm-hmm. spent quite a bit enough time on that already.
Right. So that's fine. So the I'm just trying to make sure the committee has sort of understood what they said and what the responses were, since I think they're seeing this all for the first time.
That's right.
And then the other two things we talked about were regarding whether or not the adenoma was detected at the time, and they said they record essential polyp information. Again, this is something that our GI folks felt strongly about. And basically, they don't agree with that. And then withdrawal time was another thing we talked about at length, whether it's important or not. And they felt that essentially it is important, and they have evidence that they cite about that. Their complications is item eight. They did agree with it, including the time frame of the component title as clarity and updated the title for this component. And item nine is appropriate follow-up recommendations. And they didn't specify a time frame for this, and they don't collect that information. And I guess they didn't really feel it was important to include. So in general, they didn't really find that the committee's comments were worth incorporating. Again, I would, if there's any comments from our GI colleagues about, you know, I think that we really did have a wide-ranging discussion about that they were important is my perspective. any comments about their responses? Or okay.
Well, I would have hoped for a little bit more, given the length of the discussion and the what I thought were some of the quality points that were brought up, not just from us, but also from the three societies that wrote a letter. So, I don't really know what to say when they say, "Well, we listen to you, but we're not going to change anything."
Yes. Yeah. I hear you.
This is Bonnie Paris from Quality Quest. Can I make a few comments, please?
Sure.
Okay. Well, first, there were several comments that were about elements that are included
in the measure, which is something that we've had in use for several years, you know, that there are standard of care issues such as having a standardized assessment of bowel prep and medical risk assessment, et cetera. And those are things that, you know, we are looking at the measure overall and looking at all the historical data that we have to see, you know, if, for example, if each and every single element is 100% correct all of the time, then that really doesn't contribute to the overall outcome of the measure. So, you know, for example, if the standardized medical risk assessment is performed and documented appropriately 100% of the time, you know, that's something that could be removed from the measure potentially without affecting the outcome. But right now we don't have the data on that, and to pull out elements with the assumption that, yes, these should be done all the time, but we, you know, it would create a fundamental change to the measure. So for those, it's, you know, we do take your advice seriously, and we are doing a statistical analysis to look at the feasibility of pulling out those different components. But until we can see the results of what that would look like, we can't just change the measure. And then, you know, all of the things with the stage two submission, it's based off of the experience that we've had with the measure, as it's been stated. With item six, the essential polyp information being recorded, this particular measure is looking at the colonoscopy procedure, and at the time of the procedure, we look at whether or not certain information is collected about the polyp. And for a separate measure, we do look at adenoma detection rates. And for that measure, we use whether or not there was an adenoma detected. But at the time of the colonoscopy exam, we don't have the pathologist report that confirms whether or not it's actually an adenoma. So that's why that, you know, couldn't be changed. So, you know, so I think on some of them it's kind of a disagreement in philosophy, but also, you know, if we were to remove several of the components within our measure, then it would be a fundamental change to the measure. So that's a drastic change to the concept, and we don't, you know, have that experience with the, you know, as just pulling the things out changes that composite measure. And then also with item nine, the appropriate follow-up recommendation, we don't look at the time frame, you know, for the time from the exam until the patient is given the recommendation. So we're not collecting that, you know, like, does it take 2 days or a week for the physician or physician's office to get back to the patient. We're not collecting information on that and tying it back. But we do look at what was that recommendation. Were they told to follow up in 10 years? Were they told to follow up in 2 years? And whether or not that was appropriate given the findings of the exam.
Go ahead.
I just also wanted to say that overall, I mean, we really do appreciate the input that you've given us on the measure. So, yeah, thank you.
Sure. So it sounds to me like the developer is concerned about changing the measure regarding some of our recommendations without understanding whether the components are topped out and it's been in use in their community, they want to keep using it. I suggest that probably that, you know, if you have data that will be informative for us, it'd probably be good to see that at some point. But right now we can only look at what how responsive your comments are to our concerns. Yes?
Hey, this is Phil Schoenfeld. I apologize. I was going to be on the Friday call, but I got a chance to get away to join in part. Hopefully I haven't missed too much on all the colorectal cancer screening stuff.
Oh, I thought, well, actually, we're towards
you came
the
at just the right time.
Yeah. But yeah, we don't have to rehash all the issues. I mean, basically, the concerns we have at this point, the developer is not ready to really respond to them for a variety of reasons. So they're going to work on that in terms of some other data development on their own. And I think we can, unless there are other comments about this, we can probably move on. Any other comments about this?
So, Chris?
Yep.
This is Zahid. I have one question from the developer. In item number 8, title was changed to more accurately reflect that it was the procedure, intra-procedure, or, the complications were at the time of the procedure. In item 9, where it says appropriate follow-up recommendation, and in the previous conversation we sort of did see that the time frame determines the appropriateness. I'm just curious why they were not able to change the title to just follow-up recommendation given, because that would be the more accurate thing in this particular component. Because it looks like that's what, because the appropriateness of that follow-up
right.
is not determined.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, that's a tough question to the developer, I don't know. But are you, I basically, it's an open question. I don't know the answer to that.
Just so I can, this is Phil, just to clarify, and again, I definitely don't want you to rehash it, but is the decision that, because I can't have comments if needed, but is the decision on the developer's part that they're not ready to respond to our comments again, so we're not going to move on to stage 2 at this time?
No, they have responded. They have responded, and they have a rationale for everything that they say. And the rationale is listed. And I don't know, Phil, if you had a chance to look at your...
Oh, no. Oh, no. I've read it.
Okay, you read it. So basically, with their comments, our decision is to note, whether they, A, were responsive to our comments and whether their comments are valid in terms of their response. And if it's...
So then I just have one question, quick question then, which is, should we be prepared to discuss as a committee now whether or not they were appropriately responsive before we vote, or is that something, I mean, it...
That is now, yes. That is now.
Okay.
So if you have any comments to make, that we're all ears.
Okay. I mean, my feeling, quite frankly, is that actually they, A, didn't respond appropriately to our comments, that with the exception of changing the complication rate for the their definition of complication rate, that basically all the feedback that we gave them did not lead to any significant or important changes in their indicator. And I'll be blunt in saying that I was actually rather frustrated based on the time we as a committee put in to giving them feedback about the difference between process indicators and quality indicators, that they basically ignored virtually every specific feedback we gave about the fact that the key quality indicators deal with the indication for colonoscopy being properly documented, that adenoma detection rate has to be properly documented, and that the appropriate indication for follow-up has to be properly documented, but that things such as specifying an ASA class or simply specifying whether or not a bowel prep quality was reported, regardless of the actual quality of the bowel prep, you know, my opinion pretty strongly, being the one who did most of the work on this, is that they did not respond to virtually, they did not respond in a substantive way to our comments, except to say they felt that they didn't need to actually make changes to the instrument in response to our comments.
Right. Right. I agree with that.
Right. So the that is a probably a fair assessment in my view too. The developer does have some plans to look at their data again to see if there's merit in their minds as to whether these are important comments, and I'm sure that'll be interesting for us to see at some point in the future.
Okay. I don't want to belabor the committee since, like I said, I was planning on being on the call on Friday. But the developer is not proactively stating we're not prepared to make change. The developer is saying that we're not planning on making any changes to our instrument based on our application. That's the way it looks like to me, but we wanted to move on to stage two.
Correct. That's where we are right now.
Okay. Well, I guess I've made my feelings there pretty well known about the fact that I understand the developer feels that responded to our comments, that much I appreciate, just didn't feel that it was necessary to make any changes to the instrument despite our recommendations.
Okay. That's about right. Okay, so with that, people can either use our SurveyMonkey vote or they can think about it and vote later. And then we'll go on to the last one here, which is the GI mortality rate from a hemorrhage, 2065, and that's an ARC measure. And checklist up here. The issue, I think, here was one of sensitivity versus specificity of the numerator definition. The first issue was whether or not the a primary diagnosis of a upper GI bleed was a good idea, or whether they should include other secondary diagnoses. And the developer basically responded saying that when you do that, you begin to lose specificity of what caused the death or readmission. It's here on page 3 it starts. So that was their concern, that essentially they're going for a tightly specific measure where you can really ascribe the incident to upper GI bleed, or lower upper GI bleed, and they feel that that's of benefit compared to making it more sensitive but less specific. Any comments about that? Okay. And another comment that we had was consider stratifying by upper versus lower GI bleeds, or esophageal versus lower GI bleeds. And they said that you can do that by using a denominator stratification. So that is, I guess, possible. I don't know if there's any overall comments about this. They took our comments seriously, I think, and, it's, I guess, a question of opinion as to whether it's better to be more sensitive or more specific. And any other GI comments from our GI colleagues on this? Okay, so then we can either vote or consider it and vote later. And then there's actually one more, isn't there?
Yeah.
And where can we find that?
There's another email, 635.
The last email received.
Okay, another email for the last measure that came through. Okay. Okay, so for 635, I'm opening this up. Okay, I'm sorry, there's someone talking in this. Can go to the staff, lead us through this one. I don't want to be have too much background noise.
All right, we're just going to pull it up on our screen share here. Just give us a second.
Okay, I can start then. I think it's
one I got is 622, Chris.
It's
622, that's what we're looking at.
It's at the bottom of the page. 635 is at the bottom. It was the same developer, so we only sent them one checklist.
Okay.
So what we're looking at is page, it's on page 3, is that right?
Correct.
Oh, okay. I see it.
So we're looking at 635, chronic liver disease, hepatitis A vaccination. There's only 3 of them. If people can hear me, I'll just continue. So our first comment was the numerator is inconsistent with the title of the measure.
and concerning the title of the measure to more closely align with the measure of focus. And they say if the committee is referring to the inclusion of antibody testing in the numerator, we plan to remove this test from the numerator and no longer allow tests to be sufficient to complete the numerator. And is that what we meant?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So, Chris, I have a question about this. They have removed it from the numerator, and there is an exclusion of patients with prior history of viral hepatitis. And my question is, does that also include a positive antibody test, or is it just a clinical history diagnosis?
Well, according to them, they are removing the antibody test to be...
No. They're removing it from the numerator, which is fine. My only question is that in the denominator exclusion, there is an exclusion called patient with prior history of viral hepatitis. But I just want to clarify the question. Does that include the antibody test? Because...
This is Bonnie from Access Health. No, the exclusion does not include the antibody testing. Antibody testing only comes across as positive or negative and not as a value. So we're unable to process that, which is the reason why it was the way it was prior to the NQS request. It was in the numerator. We had to infer that if somebody tested for the antibody that they intended to do something with that information. No positive or negative testing result, we can't process that information unless there's a value tied to it. So, no, it was taken out of the numerator and it is not included as an exclusion.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then the same question comes up about if a person has tested positive to receive the vaccination, and then they refer to the same solution. Is that okay with folks? Any comments about that?
No, so I assume that much of the testing that still needs to be done with the numerator exclusion will be ready by stage two?
What?
Yes.
Okay. And they are trying to harmonize this with 0399. I guess that's what they are. It was responsive, but they haven't been able to report back on any progress on that. Any general comments about this? Okay. So then we can either vote on our SurveyMonkey or we can consider it for later. And I think that's all the measures we had to review. And Kev, staff, you want to take on from here?
Yes, thank you very much, Chris. We are going to jump ahead in the interest of time. We're going to skip over the principles of measurement section, which you're welcome to review on your own time if you get a chance, and go right into the measure evaluation overview, which Tarun will be doing. So, Tarun?
Okay, great. So I believe slide 31. So as we stage two, just to give everybody again reorient now that we've gone through the checklist discussion, we had the stage one review that focused on importance to measure. There were a number of checklist items for each of the developers, and now we're going to move into stage two. So the measure will be evaluated against the remaining criteria. So as we look at the four major criteria, there is a hierarchy starting with importance to measure, which you already did in stage one. Stage two will evaluate the remaining three criteria, which include scientific acceptability, which is a must-pass criteria, usability, and feasibility. And I'll go through each of these individually. To evaluate whether any one of the four major criteria have been met, you'll evaluate several sub-criteria, and expert judgment here is very important. Each of the sub-criteria help to demonstrate whether the major criteria was met. So specifically, how do you know that a measure is scientifically acceptable? Those will be where we'll evaluate the sub-criteria to help assess this. The criteria parallel best practices for measure development. For example, we begin with something that's important to measure, and then later what is feasible. So you already have reviewed what's important to measure. Now we'll evaluate and make sure that they're scientifically acceptable, and then they're usable and feasible. It's important to keep in mind that the criteria and subcriteria are a matter of degree rather than all or nothing judgment, similar to what you did in the first stage of this effort. So I'll get into the meat here. Criteria number two is really where you'll spend the majority of your time in the evaluation in stage two. Here we're looking to evaluate the extent in which the measure as specified produces consistent and credible results for the quality of care implemented. So specifically what we're looking at is the reliability, which is a must-pass criteria, and this is similar to the discussion we were having earlier today, to ensure that there's precise specifications, including the exclusions, and that there's reliability testing either at the data element level, measure score level, or at both levels. Secondly, you'll be evaluating the validity of the measure specifications, so specifically whether the specifications are consistent with the evidence. I just want to take a moment there and highlight the fact of how this is slightly different from what we were looking at in stage one. As you'll note, when we looked at the importance to measure criteria, we were looking at whether the measures were conceptually important to measure. Here, you're going to actually look to see and ensure that the measure specifications are consistent with the evidence and make sure that the way that the measure is designed is appropriate and balanced. Secondly, we'll be looking at validity testing at the data element level or at the measure score level, ensuring that there's justification for any exclusions and how it relates to the evidence. The risk adjustment approach for outcome measures, which is really limited to just the ARC measure, if I remember correctly, ensuring that the measure is able to differentiate differences in performance and whether there's comparability across different data sources and methods, and whether there's stratification for disparities if appropriate. So again, with reliability and validity, we'll just stress that they're not all or nothing properties, but they're a matter of degree, and they vary with different conditions of using the measure. But it's important to focus on the fact that in order for it to be valid, it must be reliable, but reliability does not guarantee validity. So NQF requires that measure testing, that there's an empirical analysis to demonstrate reliability and validity of the measure as specified. This analysis should include issues that pose threats to the validity of the conclusions about quality of care, specifically exclusions, risk adjustment approaches, and methods to identify differences in performance. Some key points to keep in mind as you start to do this evaluation is that we require empirical evidence of measure testing. So this is not, it's not sufficient for measure developers to simply demonstrate that coding of the measure is reliable and valid. We expect that there's empirical evidence here, and also in terms of evidence for testing for the composite, which you'll see in the, as a few different elements that are added for the composite testing form. And that the reliability and measure and the validity is tested for the measure as specified. So if the measure has been updated in terms of stage one and stage two, we expect that the measure as specified is tested and not the measure concept. That the measure specifications under reliability are precise, evidence. NQF allows flexibility in terms of testing options. We're not prescriptive. But those testing results should be within acceptable norms. And insufficient evidence cannot be evaluated or considered for endorsement. So to the extent that there, if there are measures in this project that do not have sufficient testing, they cannot be recommended for endorsement. So while NQF requires testing for reliability and validity, we've tried to implement several methodologies here to reduce the burden of testing for developers. And what we mean by that in particular is that reliability and validity can be tested either at the data element level or at the measure score. And so what we mean by data elements here, just to give you some examples, for numerator, we're looking at A1C values, to make sure that those data elements are valid and reliable. The denominator, you can reliably get this information and identify the denominator population. Or at the measure score level, so looking at the measure score and ensuring that the measure score is reliable and valid. The testing can be done on samples, and although we would expect that the scope and extent of the testing is sufficient for the purpose of evaluation. NQF also allows face validity of the measure score as a systematic indicator of quality if it's systematically assessed. So just wanted to highlight that as well. So reliability of data elements refers to the repeatability and reproducibility of the data elements for the same population in the same time period. So examples here include intra-rater or intra-rater reliability of the coding or record abstraction as an example, or internal consistency or reliability of the item instrument. Although we don't have multi-item instruments, well, actually, we do have multi-item instruments in this project. So that's also another part that we would look at. Thanks for that clarification. So reliability of the measure score refers to the proportion of variation in the performance score that's due to systematic differences across the measured entities. So essentially what we're looking at here is the precision of the score, and examples of this could include signal-to-noise analysis, which gives you a sense of whether the variation is due to differences in performance in the measured entities versus just random noise in the measure score. So I'll just move on past this slide. Actually, it's pretty straightforward. So in the summary here, what we're really looking at is whether the test is appropriate, with the appropriate method used, and we'll ask you to consider whether or not the level, the data source, the type of measure, the topic, and potential sources of error, conceptual relationships are appropriate in terms of the testing. Secondly, whether the scope of the testing is adequate, if there's a sample, whether, you know, looking at the number of entities, the number of patients, and the representativeness of the testing, and whether the results are within acceptable norms. Again, NQF requires empirical testing of these measures. So if there are any further questions related to what we would require in terms of testing, please reach out to us, and we'll give you some additional information in terms of our testing task force recommendations on what we would require for testing. But it is a fairly high bar in terms of empirical data as the measure is specified. So I'll just move on here to just focus on a few other components here, which, again, really is only focused on one major measure that you'll be looking at. But as far as risk adjustment goes, we expect that they include patient-level factors, for example, age or diagnosis, severity, that are associated with the outcome of interest. We do not, and that don't confound with the quality of care provided. So particularly, we expect that the components that are included in the risk adjustment model are present at the start of care, so are not a result of care and then being used as risk adjusters for the outcome. Those that would not be a positive way to design a measure. Secondly, that we generally do not include measures that are associated with disparities, for example, SES or race. And we generally don't include structures or characteristics of organizations or clinicians that would be associated with quality. For instance, experience, training, or equipment would not be appropriate variables to include in the risk adjustment model. Next slide. How do we rate? I just want to spend a few seconds here to talk about how we're rating reliability and validity. So in order for a measure to be rated high for reliability and validity, there needs to be empirical evidence and testing both at the data element level and at the measure score level. If the measure is only tested at one, the highest rating it could receive is a moderate. And that is the major differentiator between high and moderate ratings on reliability and validity. And the differences between low and insufficient in terms of reliability and validity testing is that insufficient evidence does not have any empirical testing of the measure. And when we look at the overall, so on the next slide, overall, when a measure that does not pass scientific acceptability is either rated low for validity and or low for reliability and and reliability. So if a measure is rated low for either reliability or validity, it will not pass scientific acceptability, and the measure will not be endorsed. It is a must-pass criteria. So I'll turn it over to Suzanne to just quickly go over the remaining two criteria, but I will say that the majority of your evaluation will really be focused on the scientific acceptability section of the submission form.
Thanks, Tarun. Okay, so the third criteria is feasibility. Is there any questions before we dive into the next criteria? I know that was
fun. This is Zahid. I have just a quick question for Tarun. I think you mentioned that there's guidance on the testing methodologies. Do they also have minimum thresholds in them?
So we don't have minimum thresholds. We don't set minimum thresholds, again, because many of the thresholds are context specific. But they, we generally expect that they're within acceptable norms, and those acceptable norms are relatively well defined in our testing task force report, but they're not meant to be minimum thresholds.
Okay, so because I was just scanning the 0635 with the testing that they have submitted in the complete submission, and there were several, values that were used to justify the results. So I was just sort of thinking ahead that, I wasn't sure whether that was, acceptable thresholds. I guess I would just have to see what the guidance document says, whether that addresses that issue or not.
I think, there's two different avenues we could use for that. To the extent that you have specific questions on interpreting any of the results that the measure developers have submitted, please feel free to reach out to us so we can help kind of describe that in a little more detail with our lead methodologist here at NQF during the in-person or during our meeting. The other option is that we really, some of these within the panel here, there may be some that feel more strongly about what's an acceptable, scope or result for testing. But there are, we don't have minimum thresholds. I'll just underline that.
Okay.
Any other questions? All right. So feasibility is our next criteria, and that's the extent to which the required data is available, retrievable, and can be implemented. So for clinical measures, that would be things like the required data elements are generated and used during care delivery, something like blood pressure, lab tests, medication orders, stuff like that. The required data elements are available in electronic health records or other electronic sources. And the demonstration that the data collection strategy can be implemented. So, that there are not issues with patient confidentiality, with timing, costs associated with fees, of proprietary measures, that there's some indication that the implementation has either been tested or is already being used. The next criteria is there any questions on that before we go into the next one?
One question I had is, in the past, we had, this is Chris, that I've been in some NQF meetings where participation in a specific data registry was considered undue burden. Is that what's still sort of the thought process over there right now?
Chris, this is Reva. In terms of, you mean requiring to participate in the registry as the only way to collect data on the measure? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, it's feasible if you're, basically it's feasible only if you're
right.
Part of the registry, go ahead.
Yeah. I think that whole area is evolving, and registries are becoming much more prevalent, and people are involved in them much more. But I still think it's a topic to discuss and to weigh in your evaluation, because clearly there may be barriers to participating in the registry that would preclude some people from participating and therefore not be included in measurement. So you do have to weigh that in as a factor, though registries are becoming very much more used and popular.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions? All right, so the last criteria is usability and use, which is the extent to which potential audiences are using or can use performance results for both accountability and performance improvement. And in the interest of time, I'm going to just jump past this since it's pretty straightforward as well. We wanted to talk briefly about related or competing measures because that will be an issue in this project. If you have a measure that is endorsed and then you have another measure that is has the same measure focus, the same target population, and those measures would be considered competing. And so we do have that issue in this project with the hepatitis A vaccination measure. And if that measure, once you've reviewed it, and if it passes all the criteria and you recommend it for endorsement, you will then need to discuss how that should be harmonized with the other measure. And as we mentioned earlier, we've asked the developers to talk about that, and they will send us some information, which we'll share with you before the meeting in April. Briefly, we're used to high, moderate, low, insufficient rating categories for those as well. And then new versus endorsed measures. We've touched on this a bit earlier in the call. But five of the measures that we're looking at in this project have been previously endorsed. So this slide shows some of the things that you should be looking for in previously endorsed measures versus new measures. And we do seek implementation comments from our members before we look at endorsed measures for re-review, and we'll be sharing those with you shortly as well. Are there any questions? All right, so I just want to go over the next steps because there are a lot of things going on in the next few weeks. So we have another orientation call on Friday. We're going to go over the same stuff we went over today and do the same checklist discussion. You're welcome to join, but you definitely don't have to since you were on today's call. We do need you to vote on your preliminary checklist surveys if you have not done so today. I know quite a number of you did, but if you haven't, please complete those by 9 a.m. next Monday morning, and we'll let you know on Monday the results of those. We'll combine the votes of both orientation calls and let you know if all seven measures will be going forward for the full review. So at this time, you can also start looking at the full measure submission forms. Those are all posted on SharePoint. If you have trouble finding them, let us know. But you should start looking at that, and you should complete your preliminary evaluation surveys by April 1st. We sent that link out in the memo that I sent earlier, but we'll send that again next week so that you can have all that information together when we know exactly what measures we'll be reviewing. So you'll need to complete those preliminary evaluation surveys by April 1st. Those are also due at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on April 1st. We'll compile those results and send them back out to you later that day so you have a little bit of time to look over them before the first committee call on April 3rd. So that call on April 3rd, we're going to look at all the measures that are under review in this project. We'll send out an agenda so we know which measures we're going to be looking at. But that calls from 3 to 5 Eastern Time. We do request that, if at all possible, that you be at a computer during that call. Since we're going to be meeting by phone and not in person, we'll be doing online voting. So we'll need you to be online so you can access the survey tool that we'll be asking you to fill out. Since some of the criteria are must-pass, we need to know right away what your vote is on the criteria so we can move the measures along. And we'll be doing the same thing for the April 8th call. And please plan to attend both calls if you can. We need the full committee's input to decide on the measures. So we have given you quite a lot of information. Are there any questions at this time? So we expect that you may have questions as you start to review things. Once you start looking at the measures, you know, if you run into questions with the criteria, please don't hesitate to call or email any of us, and we can talk you through that. Here's all of our email addresses and our phone. Again, everything that you need is on SharePoint, and I will continue to send email updates as well.
Chris, you might want to just open the line up to public comments if there's anyone who wants to make a public comment about today's call.
Okay. Yeah, so obviously anyone this time who wants to make a public comment, please do so. Okay. I don't hear anyone. So with that, then, I guess we're concluded for today.
We are, unless there's any other outstanding questions.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for your time and participation.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.